high attainers is that they're not having good relationships. They're busy making money and attending to themselves, and that means that there's less room in their lives for love and attention and caring and empathy and the things that truly count, Ryan added. And if the broad contours of these findings are true for individuals, why shouldn't they also be true for organizations, which of course are collections of individuals? I don't mean to say that profit doesn't matter. It does. The profit motive has been an important fuel for achievement. But it's not the only motive, and it's not the most important one. Indeed, if we were to look at history's greatest achievements, from the printing press to constitutional democracy to cures for deadly diseases, the spark that kept creators working deep into the night was purpose at least as much as profit. A healthy society and healthy business organizations begins with purpose and considers profit a way to move toward that end or a happy byproduct of its attainment. And here the boomers, maybe, just maybe, can take the lead. On the subjects of autonomy and mastery, adults should look to the eloquent example of children. But perhaps purpose is another matter. Being able to contemplate the big picture, to ponder one's own mortality, to understand the paradox that attaining certain goals isn't the answer, seem to require having spent a few years on the planet. And since the planet very soon will contain more people over age 65 than under age 5 for the first time in its existence, the timing couldn't be better. It is in our nature to seek purpose. But that nature is now being revealed and expressed on a scale that is demographically unprecedented, and until recently, scarcely imaginable. The consequences could rejuvenate our businesses and remake our world. A central idea of this book has been the mismatch between what science knows and what business does. The gap is wide. Its existence is alarming. And though closing it seems daunting, we have reasons to be optimistic. The scientists who study human motivation, several of whom we've encountered in this book, offer us a sharper and more accurate account of both human performance and the human condition. The truths they've revealed are simple, yet powerful. The science shows that those typical 20th century carrot and stick motivators, things we consider somehow a natural part of human enterprise, can sometimes work. But they're effective in only a surprisingly narrow band of circumstances. The science shows that if-then rewards, the mainstays of the Motivation 2.0 operating system, not only are ineffective in many situations, but also can crush the high-level creative conceptual abilities that are central to current and future economic and social progress. The science shows that the secret to high performance isn't our biological drive or our reward and punishment drive, but our third drive, our deep-seated desire to direct our own lives, to extend and expand our abilities, and to live a life of purpose. Bringing our businesses in sync with these truths won't be easy. Unlearning old ideas is difficult. Undoing old habits even harder. And I'd be less sanguine about the prospects of closing the motivation gap anytime soon if it weren't for this. The science confirms what we already know in our hearts. We know that human beings are not merely smaller, slower, better-smelling horses galloping after that day's carrot. We know, if we spent time with young children or remember ourselves at our best, that we're not destined to be passive and compliant. We're designed to be active and engaged. And we know that the richest experiences in our lives aren't when we're clamoring for validation from others, but when we're listening to our own voice, doing something that matters, doing it well, and doing it in the service of a cause larger than ourselves. So in the end, repairing the mismatch and bringing our understanding of motivation into the 21st century is more than an essential move for business. It's an affirmation of our humanity. Part 3, The Type I Toolkit. This next section is the Type I Toolkit. It's your guide to taking the ideas in this book and putting them into action. Whether you're looking for a better way to run your organization, navigate your career, or help your kids, there's a tip, a best practice, or a recommended book for you. Also, I'd love to hear your suggestions for what to include in future editions of the Type I Toolkit. Send your ideas directly to me at dhp@danpink.com. Type I for Individuals, 8 Strategies for Awakening Your Motivation. Type I's are made, not born. Although the world is awash in extrinsic motivators, there's a lot we can do to bring more autonomy, mastery, and purpose into our work and life. Here are 8 exercises to get you on the right track. Exercise 1. Give yourself a flow test. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi did more than discover the concept of flow. He also introduced an ingenious new technique to measure it. Csikszentmihalyi and his University of Chicago team equipped participants in their research studies with electronic pagers. Then they paged people at random intervals, approximately 8 times a day for a week, asking them to describe their mental state at that moment. Compared with previous methods, these real-time reports prove far more honest and revealing. You can use Csikszentmihalyi's methodological innovation in your own quest for mastery by giving yourself a flow test. Set a reminder on your computer or mobile phone to go off at 40 random times in a week. Each time your device beeps, write down what you're doing, how you're feeling, and whether you're in flow. Record your observations, look at the patterns, and consider the following questions. Which moments produced feelings of flow? Where were you? What were you working on? Who were you with? Are certain times of the day more flow-friendly than others? How could you restructure your day based on your findings? How might you increase the number of optimal experiences and reduce the moments when you felt disengaged or distracted? If you're having doubts about your job or career, what does this exercise tell you about your true source of intrinsic motivation? Exercise 2. First, ask a big question. In 1962, Clare Boothe Luce, one of the first women to serve in the U.S. Congress, offered some advice to President John F. Kennedy. "A great man," she told him, "is one sentence." Abraham Lincoln's sentence was, "He preserved the Union and freed the slaves." Franklin Roosevelt's was, "He lifted us out of a Great Depression and helped us win a world war." Luce feared that Kennedy's attention was so splintered among different priorities that his sentence risked becoming a muddled paragraph. You don't have to be a president of the United States or of your local gardening club to learn from this tale. One way to orient your life toward greater purpose is to think about your sentence. Maybe it's, "He raised 4 kids who became healthy and happy adults," or "She invented a device that made people's lives easier," or "He cared for every person who walked into his office regardless of whether that person could pay," or "She taught 2 generations of children how to read." As you contemplate your purpose, begin with the big question. What's your sentence? Exercise 3. Then keep asking a small question. The big question is necessary but not sufficient. That's where the small question comes in. Real achievement doesn't happen overnight. As anyone who's trained for a marathon, learned a new language, or run a successful division can attest, you spend a lot more time grinding through tough tasks than you do basking in applause. Here's something you can do to keep yourself motivated. At the end of each day, ask yourself whether you were better today than you were yesterday. Did you do more? Did you do it well? Or to get specific, did you learn your 10 vocabulary words, make your 8 sales calls, eat your 5 servings of fruits and vegetables, write your 4 pages? You don't have to be flawless each day. Instead, look for small measures of improvement, such as how long you practice your saxophone, or whether you held off checking email until you finished that report you needed to write. Reminding yourself that you don't need to be a master by day 3 is the best way of ensuring you will be one by day 3,000. So before you go to sleep each night, ask yourself the small question. Was I better today than yesterday? Exercise 4. Take a Sagmeister. The designer Stefan Sagmeister has found a brilliant way to ensure he's living a Type I life. Think about the standard pattern in developed countries, he says. people usually spend the first 25 or so years of their lives learning, the next 40 or so years working, and the final 25 in retirement. That boilerplate timeline got Sagmeister wondering. Why not snip 5 years from retirement and sprinkle them into your working years? So every 7 years, Sagmeister closes his graphic design shop, tells his clients he won't be back for a year, and goes off on a 365-day sabbatical. He uses the time to travel, to live places he's never been, and to experiment with new projects. It sounds risky, I know, but he says the ideas he generates during the year off often provide his income for the next 7 years. Taking a Sagmeister, as I now call it, requires a fair bit of planning and saving, of course. But doesn't foregoing that big-screen TV seem a small price to pay for an unforgettable and unget-backable year of personal exploration? The truth is, this idea is more realistic than many of us realize, which is why I hope to take a Sagmeister in a couple of years, and why you should consider it too. Exercise 5. Give yourself a performance review. Performance reviews, those annual or biannual rituals of organizational life, are about as enjoyable as a toothache and as productive as a train wreck. Nobody likes them, not the giver, not the receiver. They don't really help us achieve mastery, since feedback often comes 6 months after the work is complete. Imagine Serena Williams or Twyla Tharp seeing their results or reading reviews only twice a year. And yet managers keep on hauling employees into their offices for those awkward, painful encounters. Maybe there's a better way. Maybe, as Douglas McGregor and others have suggested, we should give ourselves our own performance reviews. Here's how. Figure out your goals, mostly learning goals, but a few performance goals, and then every month, call yourself to your office and give yourself an appraisal. How are you faring? Where are you falling short? What tools, information, or support might you need to do better? Some other hints. Set both smaller and larger goals so that when it comes time to evaluate yourself, you've already accomplished some whole tasks. Make sure you understand how every aspect of your work relates to your larger purpose. Be brutally honest. This exercise is aimed at helping you improve performance and achieve mastery. So if you rationalize failures or gloss over your mistakes instead of learning from them, you're wasting your time. And if doing this solo isn't your thing, gather a small group of colleagues for regular peer-based do-it-yourself performance reviews. If your comrades really care, they'll tell you the truth and hold you accountable. One last question for bosses. Why in God's name are you not encouraging all your employees to do this? Exercise 6. Get unstuck by going oblique. Even the most intrinsically motivated person sometimes gets stuck. So here's a simple, easy, and fun way to power out of your mental morass. In 1975, producer Brian Eno and artist Peter Schmidt published a set of 100 cards containing strategies that help them overcome the pressure-packed moments that always accompany a deadline. Each card contains a single, often inscrutable question or statement to push you out of a mental rut. Some examples. What would your closest friend do? Your mistake was a hidden intention. What is the simplest solution? Repetition is a form of change. Don't avoid what is easy. If you're working on a project and find yourself stymied, pull an oblique card from the deck. These brain bombs are a great way to keep your mind open despite constraints you can't control. You can buy the deck at www.enoshop.co.uk or follow one of the Twitter accounts inspired by the strategies, such as twitter.com/oblique_chirps. Exercise 7. Move 5 steps closer to mastery. One key to mastery is what Florida State University psychology professor Anders Ericsson calls deliberate practice, a lifelong period of effort to improve performance in a specific domain. Deliberate practice isn't running a few miles each day or banging on the piano for 20 minutes each morning. It's much more purposeful, focused, and yes, painful. Follow these steps over and over again for a decade, and you just might become a master. Step 1. Remember that deliberate practice has one objective, to improve performance. People who play tennis once a week for years don't get any better if they do the same thing each time, Erickson has said. Deliberate practice is about changing your performance, setting new goals, and straining yourself to reach a bit higher each time. Step 2. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Repetition matters. Basketball greats don't shoot 10 free throws at the end of team practice. They shoot 500. Step 3. Seek constant, critical feedback. If you don't know how you're doing, you won't know what to improve. Step 4. Focus ruthlessly on where you need help. While many of us work on what we're already good at, says Erickson, those who get better work on their weaknesses. Step 5. Prepare for the process to be mentally and physically exhausting. That's why so few people commit to it, but that's why it works. Exercise 8. Take a page from Weber and a card from your pocket. In his insightful book, Rules of Thumb, Fast Company magazine co-founder Alan Weber offers a smart and simple exercise for assessing whether you're on the path to autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Get a few blank 3x5-inch cards. On one of the cards, write your answer to this question. What gets you up in the morning? Now, on the other side of the card, write your answer to another question. What keeps you up at night? Pair each response to a single sentence. And if you don't like an answer, toss the card and try again until you've crafted something you can live with. Then read what you've produced. If both answers give you a sense of meaning and direction, congratulations, says Weber. Use them as a compass, checking from time to time to see if they're still true. If you don't like one or both of your answers, it opens up a new question. What are you going to do about it? Type I for organizations. 9 ways to improve your company, office, or group. Whether you're the CEO or the new intern, you can help create engaging, productive workplaces that foster Type I behavior. Here are 9 ways to begin pulling your organization out of the past and into the brighter world of Motivation 3.0. Exercise 1. Try 20% time with training wheels. You've heard about the wonders of 20% time, where organizations encourage employees to spend 1/5 of their hours working on any project they want. And if you've ever used Gmail or read Google News, you've benefited from the results. But for all the virtues of this Type I innovation, putting such a policy in place can seem daunting. How much will it cost? What if it doesn't work? If you're feeling skittish, here's an idea. Go with a more modest version, 20% time with training wheels. Start with, say, 10% time. That's just one afternoon of a 5-day work week. Who among us hasn't wasted that amount of time at work anyway? And instead of committing to it forever, try it for 6 months. By creating this island of autonomy, you'll help people act on their great ideas and convert their downtime into more productive time. And who knows? Someone in your operation just might invent the next Post-it note. Exercise 2. Encourage peer-to-peer, now that rewards. Kimley Horn and Associates, a civil engineering firm in Raleigh, North Carolina, has established a reward system that gets the Type I stamp of approval. At any point, without asking permission, anyone in the company can award a $50 bonus to any of her colleagues. It works because it's real time and it's not handed down from any management, the firm's human resources director told Fast Company. Any employee who does something exceptional receives recognition from their peers within minutes. Because these bonuses are non-contingent now-that rewards, they avoid the 7 deadly flaws of most corporate carrots. And because they come from a colleague, not a boss, they carry a different and perhaps deeper meaning. You could even say they're motivating. Exercise 3. Conduct an autonomy audit. How much autonomy do the people in your organization really have? If you're like most folks, you probably don't have a clue. Nobody does. But there's a way to find out, with an autonomy audit. Ask everyone in your department or on your team to respond to these four questions with a numerical ranking, using a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 meaning almost none, and 10 meaning a huge amount. 1. How much autonomy do you have over your tasks at work, your main responsibilities and what you do in a given day? 2. How much autonomy do you have over your time at work? For instance, when you arrive, when you leave, and how you allocate your hours each day. 3. How much autonomy do you have over your team at work? That is, to what extent are you able to choose the people with whom you typically collaborate? 4. How much autonomy do you have over your technique at work? How you actually perform the main responsibilities of your job? Make sure all the responses are anonymous. Then tabulate the results. What's the employee average? The figure will fall somewhere on a 40-point autonomy scale, with 0 being a North Korean prison and 40 being Woodstock. Compare that number to people's perceptions. Perhaps the boss thought everyone had plenty of freedom, but the audit showed an average autonomy rating of only 15. Also calculate separate results for task, time, team, and technique. A healthy overall average can sometimes mask a problem in a particular area. An overall autonomy rating of, say, 27 isn't bad. However, if that average consists of 8 each for task, technique, and team, but only 3 for time, you've identified an autonomy weak spot in the organization. It's remarkable sometimes how little the people running organizations know about the experiences of the people working around them. But it's equally remarkable how often leaders are willing to do things differently if they see real data. That's what an autonomy audit can do. And if you include a section in your audit for employees to jot down their own ideas about increasing autonomy, you might even find some great solutions. Exercise 4. Take 3 steps toward giving up control. Type X bosses, relish control. Type I bosses, relinquish control. Extending people the freedom they need to do great work is usually wise, but it's not always easy. So if you're feeling the urge to control, here are 3 ways to begin letting go, for your own benefit and your team's. 1. Involve people in goal setting. Would you rather set your own goals or have them foisted upon you? Thought so. Why should those working with you be any different? A considerable body of research shows that individuals are far more engaged when they're pursuing goals they had a hand in creating. So bring employees into the process. They could surprise you. People often have higher aims than the ones you assign them. 2. Use non-controlling language. Next time you're about to say must or should, try saying think about or consider instead. A small change in wording can help promote engagement over compliance and might even reduce some people's urge to defy. Think about it, or at least consider it, okay? 3. Hold office hours. Sometimes you need to summon people into your office, but sometimes it's wise to let them come to you. Take a cue from college professors and set aside 1 or 2 hours a week when your schedule is clear and any employee can come in and talk to you about anything that's on her mind. Your colleagues might benefit, and you might learn something. Exercise 5. Play Whose Purpose Is It Anyway? This is another exercise designed to close the gap between perception and reality. Gather your team, your department, or, if you can, all the employees in your outfit. Hand everyone a blank 3x5-inch card. Then ask each person to write down his or her 1-sentence answer to the following question. What is our company's or our organization's purpose? Collect the cards and read them aloud. What do they tell you? Are the answers similar, everyone aligned along a common purpose? Or are they all over the place? Some people believing one thing, others something completely different, and still others without even a guess. For all the talk about culture, alignment, and mission, most organizations do a pretty shabby job of assessing this aspect of their business. This simple inquiry can offer a glimpse into the soul of your enterprise. If people don't know why they're doing what they're doing, how can you expect them to be motivated to do it? Exercise 6. Use Reich's pronoun test. Former U.S. Labor Secretary Robert B. Reich has devised a smart, simple, and free diagnostic tool for measuring the health of an organization. When he talks to employees, he listens carefully for the pronouns they use. Do employees refer to their company as they or as we? They suggests at least some amount of disengagement and perhaps even alienation. We suggests the opposite, that employees feel they're part of something significant and meaningful. If you're a boss, spend a few days listening to the people around you, not only in formal settings like meetings, but in the hallways and at lunch as well. Are you a we organization or a they organization? The difference matters. Everybody wants autonomy, mastery, and purpose. The thing is, we can get it, but they can't. Exercise 7. Design for intrinsic motivation. Internet guru and author Clay Shirky says that the most successful websites and electronic forums have a certain type I approach in their DNA. They're designed, often explicitly, to tap intrinsic motivation. You can do the same with your online presence if you listen to Shirky and create an environment that makes people feel good about participating. Give users autonomy. Keep the system as open as possible. And what matters in cyberspace matters equally in physical space. Ask yourself, how does the built environment of your workplace promote or inhibit autonomy, mastery, and purpose? Exercise 8. Promote Goldilocks for groups. Almost everyone has experienced the satisfaction of a Goldilocks task, the kind that's neither too easy nor too hard, that delivers a delicious sense of flow. But sometimes it's difficult to replicate that experience when you're working in a team. People often end up doing the jobs they always do because they've proven they can do them well, and an unfortunate few get saddled with the flow-free tasks nobody else wants. Here are a few ways to bring a little Goldilocks to your group. 1. Begin with a diverse team. As Harvard's Teresa Amabile advises, set up work groups so that people will stimulate each other and learn from each other so that they're not homogeneous in terms of their backgrounds and training. You want people who can really cross-fertilize each other's ideas. 2. Make your group a no-competition zone. Pitting coworkers against one another in the hope that competition will spark them to perform better rarely works and almost always undermines intrinsic motivation. If you're going to use a C word, go with collaboration or cooperation. 3. Try a little task shifting. If someone is bored with his current assignment, see if he can train someone else in the skills he's already mastered. Then see if he can take on some aspect of a more experienced team member's work. 4. Animate with purpose, don't motivate with rewards. Nothing bonds a team like a shared mission. The more that people share a common cause, whether it's creating something insanely great, outperforming an outside competitor, or even changing the world, the more your group will do deeply satisfying and outstanding work. Exercise 9. Turn your next offsite into a FedEx day. Behold the company offsite, a few spirit-sapping days of forced fun and manufactured morale featuring awkward pep talks, wretched dancing, and a few trust falls. To be fair, some offsites re-engage employees, recharge people's batteries, and restart conversations on big issues. But if your organization's offsites are falling short, why not try replacing the next one with a FedEx day? Set aside an entire day where employees can work on anything they choose, however they want, with whomever they'd like. Make sure they have the tools and resources they need, and impose just one rule. People must deliver something. A new idea, a prototype of a product, a better internal process, the following day. Type I organizations know what their Type X counterparts rarely comprehend. Real challenges are far more invigorating than controlled leisure. The Zen of Compensation. Paying people the Type I way. Everybody wants to be paid well. I sure do. I bet you're the same. The type I approach to motivation doesn't require bargain basement wages or an all-volunteer workforce, but it does demand a new approach to pay. Think of this new approach as the Zen of compensation. In Motivation 3.0, the best use of money is to take the issue of money off the table. The more prominent salary, perks, and benefits are in someone's work life, the more they can inhibit creativity and unravel performance. As Edward Deci explained in Chapter 3, when organizations use rewards like money to motivate staff, that's when they're most demotivating. The better strategy is to get compensation right and then get it out of sight. Effective organizations compensate people in amounts and in ways that allow individuals to mostly forget about compensation and instead focus on the work itself. Here are three key techniques. 1. Ensure internal and external fairness. The most important aspect of any compensation package is fairness. And here, fairness comes in two varieties, internal and external. Internal fairness means paying people commensurate with their colleagues. External fairness means paying people in line with others doing similar work in similar organizations. Let's look at each type of fairness. Suppose you and Fred have adjoining cubicles, and suppose you've got pretty much equivalent responsibility and experience. If Fred makes scads more money than you, you'll be miffed. Because of this violation of internal fairness, your motivation will plummet. Now suppose instead that you and Fred are both auditors with 10 years experience working in a Fortune 200 company. If you discover that auditors with similar experience at other Fortune 200 firms are making double your salaries, both you and Fred will experience a largely irreversible motivation dip. The company has violated the ethic of external fairness. One important addendum. Paying people the type I weigh doesn't mean paying everyone the same amount. If Fred has a harder job or contributes more to the organization than you, he deserves a richer deal. And as it turns out, several studies have shown that most people don't have a beef with that. Why? It's fair. Getting the internal and external equity right isn't itself a motivator, but it's a way to avoid putting the issue of money back on the table and making it a demotivator. 2. Pay more than average. If you have provided adequate baseline rewards and established internal and external fairness, consider borrowing a strategy first surfaced by a Nobel laureate. In the mid-1980s, George Ekerlof, who later won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and his wife, Janet Yellen, who's also an economist, discovered that some companies seem to be overpaying their workers. Instead of paying employees the wages that supply and demand would have predicted, they gave their workers a little more. It wasn't because the companies were selfless, and it wasn't because they were stupid. It was because they were savvy. Paying great people more than the market demands, these economists found, could attract better talent, reduce turnover, and boost productivity and morale. Higher wages could actually reduce a company's costs. The pay more than average approach can offer an elegant way to bypass if-then rewards, eliminate concerns about unfairness, and help take the issue of money off the table. It's another way to allow people to focus on the work itself. Indeed, other economists have shown that providing an employee a high level of base pay does more to boost performance and organizational commitment than an attractive bonus structure. Of course, by the very nature of the exercise, paying above average will work for only about half of you. So get going before your competitors do. 3. If you use performance metrics, make them wide-ranging, relevant, and hard to game. Imagine you're a product manager and your pay depends largely on reaching a particular sales goal for the next quarter. If you're smart, or if you've got a family to feed, you're going to try mightily to hit that number. You probably won't concern yourself much with the quarter after that or the health of the company or whether the firm is investing enough in research and development. And if you're nervous, you might cut corners to reach your quarterly goal. Now imagine you're a product manager and your pay is determined by these factors. Your sales for the next quarter, your sales in the current year, the company's revenue and profit in the next 2 years, levels of satisfaction among your customers, ideas for new products, and evaluations of your coworkers. If you're smart, you'll probably try to sell your product, serve your customers, help your teammates, and, well, do good work. When metrics are varied, they're harder to finagle. In addition, the gain for reaching the metrics shouldn't be too large. When the payoff for reaching targets is modest rather than massive, it's less likely to narrow people's focus or encourage them to take the low road. To be sure, finding the right mix of metrics is difficult and will vary considerably across organizations. And some people will inevitably find a way to game even the most carefully calibrated system. But using a variety of measures that reflect the totality of great work can transform often counterproductive if-then rewards into less combustible now-that rewards. Type I for parents and educators. 9 ideas for helping our kids. All kids start out as curious, self-directed type I's, but many of them end up as disengaged, compliant type X's. What's going on? Maybe the problem is us, the adults who are running schools and heading families. If we want to equip young people for the new world of work, and more important, if we want them to lead satisfying lives, we need to break Motivation 2.0's grip on education and parenting. Unfortunately, as with business, there's a mismatch between what science knows and what schools do. Science knows, and you do too if you listen to Chapter 2, that if you promise a preschooler a fancy certificate for drawing a picture, that child will likely draw a picture for you and then lose further interest in drawing. Yet in the face of this evidence, and as the world economy demands more non-routine, creative, conceptual abilities, too many schools are moving in the wrong direction. They're redoubling their emphasis on routines, right answers, and standardization. And they're hauling out a wagon full of if-then rewards. Pizza for reading books, iPods for showing up to class, cash for good test scores. We're bribing students into compliance instead of challenging them into engagement. We can do better, and we should. If we want to raise Type I kids at school and at home, we need to help move them toward autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Here are 9 ways to start the journey. 1. Apply the 3-part Type I test for homework. Does the homework bulging from kids' backpacks truly help them learn? Or does it simply steal their free time in the service of a false sense of rigor? Teachers, before you dole out yet another time-consuming assignment, run it through this Type I homework test by asking yourself 3 questions. 1. Am I offering students any autonomy over how and when to do this work? 2. Does this assignment promote mastery by offering a novel, engaging task, as opposed to rote reformulation of something already covered in class? 3. Do my students understand the purpose of this assignment? That is, can they see how doing this additional activity at home contributes to the larger enterprise in which the class is engaged? If the answer to any of these questions is no, can you refashion the assignment? And parents, are you looking at homework assignments every so often to see whether they promote compliance or engagement? Let's not waste our kids' time on meaningless exercises. With a little thought and effort, we can turn homework into home learning. 2. Have a FedEx day. In Chapter 4, we learned how the software company Atlassian injects a burst of autonomy into its workplace by setting aside a day each quarter when employees can work on any project they choose, however they want, with whomever they'd like. Why not try this with your students, or even your own sons and daughters? Set aside an entire school day, or a family vacation day, and ask kids to come up with a problem to solve or a project to tackle. In advance, help them collect the tools, information, and supplies they might need. Then let them have at it. The next morning, ask them to deliver by reporting back to the class or the family on their discoveries and experiences. It's like Project Runway, only the kids come up with the projects themselves, and the reward at the end of the day is the chance to share what they've created and all they've learned along the way. 3. Try DIY report cards. Too many students walk through the schoolhouse door with one aim in mind: to get good grades. And all too often, the best way to reach this goal is to get with the program, avoid risks, and serve up the answers the teacher wants the way the teacher wants them. Good grades become a reward for compliance, but don't have much to do with learning. Meanwhile, students whose grades don't measure up often see themselves as failures and give up trying to learn. The Type I approach is different. Report cards are not a potential prize, but a way to offer students useful feedback on their progress. And Type I students understand that a great way to get feedback is to evaluate their own progress. So try experimenting with the DIY or do-it-yourself report card. At the beginning of a semester, ask students to list their top learning goals. Then at the end of the semester, ask them to create their own report card along with a one or two paragraph review of their progress. Where did they succeed? Where did they fall short? What more do they need to learn? Once students have completed their DIY report cards, show them the teacher's report card and let the comparison of the two be the start of a conversation on how they are doing on their path toward mastery. Maybe even include students in any parent-teacher conferences. Parents, if your child's teacher won't go for these DIY report cards, try it yourself at home. It's another way to prevent school from changing your child's default setting and turning him from type I to type X. 4. Give your kids an allowance and some chores, but don't combine them. Here's why an allowance is good for kids. Having a little of their own money and deciding how to save or spend it offers a measure of autonomy and teaches them to be responsible with cash. Here's why household chores are good for kids. Chores show kids that families are built on mutual obligations and that family members need to help each other. Here's why combining allowances with chores is not good for kids. By linking money to the completion of chores, parents turn an allowance into an if-then reward. This sends kids a clear and clearly wrong-headed message. In the absence of a payment, no self-respecting child would willingly set the table, empty the garbage, or make her own bed. It converts a moral and familial obligation into just another commercial transaction, and teaches that the only reason to do a less than desirable task for your family is in exchange for payment. This is a case where combining two good things gives you less, not more. So keep allowance and chores separate, and you just might get that trash emptied. Even better, your kids will begin to learn the difference between principles and payoffs. 5. Offer praise the right way. Done right, praise is an important way to give kids feedback and encouragement. But done wrong, praise can become yet another if-then reward that can squash creativity and stifle intrinsic motivation. The powerful work of psychologist Carol Dweck, as well as others in the field, offers a how-to list for offering praise in a way that promotes type I behavior. 1. Praise effort and strategy, not intelligence. As Dweck's research has shown, children who are praised for being smart often believe that every encounter is a test of whether they really are. So to avoid looking dumb, they resist new challenges and choose the easiest path. By contrast, kids who understand that effort and hard work lead to mastery and growth are more willing to take on new, difficult tasks. 2. Make praise specific. Parents and teachers should give kids useful information about their performance. Instead of bathing them in generalities, tell them specifically what they've done that's noteworthy. 3. Praise in private. Praise is feedback, not an award ceremony. That's why it's often best to offer it one-on-one, in private. 4. Offer praise only when there's a good reason for it. Don't kid a kid. He can see through fake praise in a nanosecond. Be sincere or keep quiet. If you overpraise, kids regard it as dishonest and unearned. Plus, overpraising becomes another if-then reward that makes earning praise rather than moving toward mastery the objective. 6. Help kids see the big picture. In education systems tilted toward standardized tests, grades, and if-then rewards, students often have no idea why they're doing what they're doing. Turn that around by helping them glimpse the big picture. Whatever they're studying, be sure they can answer these questions. Why am I learning this? How is it relevant to the world I live in now? Then get out of the classroom and apply what they're studying. If they're learning Spanish, take them to an office, a store, or a community center where they can actually speak the language. If they're studying geometry, have them draw up architectural plans for an addition to your school or home. If they're taking history, ask them to apply what they've learned to an event in the news. Think of it as the fourth R: reading, writing, arithmetic, and relevance. 7. Check out these 5 Type I schools. Although most schools around the world are still built atop the Motivation 2.0 operating system, a number of forward-thinking educators have long understood that young people are brimming with the third drive. Here are 5 Type I schools in the United States with practices to emulate and stories to inspire. Big Picture Learning. Since 1996, with the opening of its flagship public high school, The Met, in Providence, Rhode Island, Big Picture Learning has been creating places that cultivate engagement rather than demand compliance. Founded by 2 veteran education innovators, Dennis Lifke and Elliot Washore, Big Picture is a nonprofit that now has 60-plus schools around the United States that put students in charge of their own education. Big Picture kids get the basics, but they also use those basics and acquire other skills by doing real work in the community, all under the guidance of an experienced adult tutor. And instead of easily gamed Motivation 2.0 measurements, Big Picture kids are assessed the way adults are, on work performance, individual presentations, effort, attitude, and behavior on the job. Most of the students at the Met and other Big Picture schools are at-risk, low-income, and minority kids who've been poorly served by conventional schools. Yet thanks to this innovative Type I approach, more than 95% graduate and go on to college. For more information, go to www.bigpicture.org. Full disclosure, I have served unpaid on the board of directors of Big Picture since 2007. Sudbury Valley School. Take a look at this independent school in Framingham, Massachusetts, to see what happens when young kids have genuine autonomy. Working from the assumption that all human beings are naturally curious and that the best kind of learning happens when it's initiated and pursued by the one doing the learning, Sudbury Valley School gives its students total control over the task, time, and technique of their learning. Teachers and staff are there to help them make things happen. This is a school where engagement is the rule and compliance isn't an option. For more information, go to www.sudval.org. The Tinkering School. More of a lab than a school, this summer program, created by computer scientist Jeever Tully, lets children from 7 to 17 play around with interesting stuff and build cool things. At the headquarters in Montara, California, Tully's tinkerers have built working zip lines, motorcycles, toothbrush robots, roller coasters, and plastic bag bridges strong enough to hold people. Most of us aren't able to ship our kids out to California for a week of tinkering, but we can all learn the 5 dangerous things you should let your children do. So take 9 minutes to listen to Tully's 2007 online TED Talk of that title. Then hand your kids a pocket knife, some power tools, and a book of matches, and get out of the way. For more information, go to www.tinkeringschool.com, which includes a link to Tully's talk. Puget Sound Community School. Like Sudbury and Big Picture, this tiny independent school in Seattle, Washington, gives its students a radical dose of autonomy, turning the one-size-fits-all approach of conventional schools on its head. Each student has an advisor who acts as her personal coach, helping her come up with her own learning goals. School consists of a mixture of class time and self-created independent study projects, along with community service devised by the students. Since youngsters are often away from campus, they gain a clear sense that their learning has a real-world purpose. And rather than chase after grades, they've received frequent, informal feedback from advisors, teachers, and peers. For more information, go to www.pscs.org. Montessori Schools. Dr. Maria Montessori developed the Montessori method of teaching in the early 1900s after observing children's natural curiosity and innate desire to learn.